Good evening, everyone. John Pett's alcoholic. I want to first thank the committee for asking me to come and speak at the first meeting of the conference. Scott, thank you. The conference's next co-chair is Leah. And they will be able to experience this in a few years. I think they ought to officially change the name of this meeting to the has-been meeting. As opposed to the early bird speaker meeting, because we're all has-beens now if you get to speak at this meeting. But it is with great pleasure that I'm here today. You know, I felt right at home this evening. I sat down and pulled my chair up, and there was gum underneath the chair, just like the bars I used to sit in, just like the bars and the places I used to go and the people I used to play with. So it was great to be here. And you know, I want to take a minute before I actually start telling you my story and ask everybody when you go home tonight to say a prayer. We lost one of my heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous this week. The man has been my sponsor for the last 7 years. Peter F. Died on Tuesday afternoon. And Peter was an integral part of this roundup for many, many years. Was a tireless worker here, and I just ask that you go home and say a prayer for his family and his loved ones. He will be missed. I'm going to intersperse some funny stories about Peter. I have a lot of them, I can tell you that, at this conference and in my life, and so as I go on in my story, you'll hear those. But I have a sobriety date. It's January 31st of 1985. And my home group is Cedar Street Men's here in San Diego. That's where you'll find me on Sunday mornings when I'm in town, unless I have a prior Alcoholics Anonymous commitment. My first sponsor, and I want you to know if you have trouble following me tonight, there's a reason for that. My first sponsor is sitting to my left, Jimmy. He led me well and taught me well. You know, the book, what can you say? You know, the book was just not ready. I mean, you know, Jimmy and I had a lot of good times. And I love the man, and he is a friend of mine and also a tireless worker in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and if there's one thing that I could share with you and you take out of here, it's that we do things in Alcoholics Anonymous. What I say from this podium is really pretty immaterial. It's what we do when we leave these rooms, and whether or not we're doing the work to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, Jimmy taught me from a very early time in my sobriety that service work is terribly inconvenient. It should be inconvenient. Peter made sure that I understood that message and that lesson. You know, he reminded me constantly that it didn't count unless it was inconvenient. But the fact of the matter is it's what we do. It's not what we say, you know. And I watch people, and people watch me. And, you know, I chased Jimmy, new in sobriety, and he was busier than I was. And I've chased Peter for the last 6 or 7 years, and he was always busier than I was. And you know, that's the example that has been set for me. That's the bar that's set for me. And you know, I will never ever be able to reach that bar. I will fail because I'm human. And that's just the way it is. But, you know, the bar has been set really high for me, and I'm very, very grateful that I've had that example from those men in my life. You know, I met Jimmy when I was in a treatment center in 1984. And, you know, I spent the summer at his house. I would show up at his house at 7 o'clock in the morning. I wouldn't leave until 10 o'clock at night, and we would spend the day at his place or at the Lemon Grove Alano Club in meetings or talking to other drunks. And, you know, I was terribly inconvenient to Jimmy. He used to refer to me as the most irritating newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous. So if your sponsor is telling you that, it's okay, because you know something, you're helping that sponsor stay sober. You know, and if you've got a sponsee who you're sitting there going, this son of a gun is the most irritating newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous, be grateful you have one. Because, you know, that sponsee will keep you sober. And, you know, one thing I've learned in the years that I've been here in Alcoholics Anonymous is I don't know who in this room is going to keep me sober today. Who's going to help me stay sober today and tomorrow? You know, it's a little after six. It's still early. You know, and, you know, I've got a shot today because I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But there are no guarantees. There's a lot of time between me and my last drink, but I'm just as close to my next drink as any person in this room. And, you know, if I remember that, I got a shot. So it's having people like that in my life for me to be able to follow that have been just so important to me. You know, my story is pretty boring, really. I'm a little white kid from the suburbs. I grew up in a small town on the East Coast. Neither of my parents drank. I had an alcoholic uncle, and my best friend's father was an alcoholic, and that was what I thought an alcoholic was. You know, that was the person. My uncle was the kind of guy who would come to family functions and would steal money from the purses and from the wallets and go buy a bottle and end up in an alley or on somebody's doorstep, passed out, and my older brothers would have to go find him and haul him back to the house. My best friend's father was an angry, mean drunk who beat the kids and was abusive. And, you know, we would get up and we could never understand why he was always sucking on peppermint lifesavers. Took me a long time to figure that out, but I did figure it out. It's because he drank all the time. All the time. And those were my examples of what an alcoholic was. Now, what's interesting about that is that you figure that with that experience, I might have heard about Alcoholics Anonymous before I got here. And the reality is I never did. I didn't know Alcoholics Anonymous existed. And when I heard about it, I didn't know what it was. But I took that image of what an alcoholic is in my mind, and I used it to rationalize and justify and defend my drinking and to defend my behavior and my right to drink. You know, and I used that for many, many years. I said, you know, I'm not like that. I'm not alcoholic. You know, we heard it tonight in chapter 3. You know, the persistence, the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that he will control and enjoy his drinking. You know, I don't want to admit that I'm mentally and bodily different from my fellows, but I am. And the fact of the matter is that I chased that illusion, I chased that lie for a long time, and it almost killed me. You know, this is, you know, Peter died of basically liver failure. And he was sick for many, many years, but it was alcoholism that killed him. He was paying the price of the wreckage of his past. You know, and the death certificate will not say alcoholism, but it was alcoholism. You know, the car crashes, they don't say alcoholism. The heart failure don't say alcoholism. The suicides don't say alcoholism. You know, and if you're in this room and you know, you think about that being an alcoholic is some sort of badge of honor, you know, just remember that we suffer from a spiritual malady that is the number one killer in the world. The number one. We don't know that because it doesn't say that on the death certificates. It's also the second leading cause of insanity, permanent insanity. That's what we suffer from, this spiritual malady, you know, this illness of alcoholism. You know, and the fact is that we're also blessed. We are blessed in a way because we're in this room and we're sober tonight. You know, there are many, many people out there. The odds are not good for recovery. There are many people out there who are suffering from alcoholism who never get to these rooms, but we've got a chance, you know, and it's just a real blessing and a real honor to be here. So anyway, I took that image of what an alcoholic was, and, you know, I'm like a lot of people, I took my first drink as a teenager, and the first few times I drank, I did not drink in a socially acceptable manner. You know, I passed out and made messes. Some of them external, some of them in people's homes, and you know, otherwise it was not a very pretty sight. And then I had my first brilliant idea as an alcoholic. And you know, if you hear an alcoholic say, "I got an idea," or "I got a plan," either tell them, "I want to hear your plan," or run. One of the two, because something bad's going to happen. And my first brilliant idea as an alcoholic was to treat my alcoholism with drugs. And that was my first treatment plan. And, you know, like every other non-spiritual, if you will, non-God-based solution to the problem of alcoholism, I drank again. And, you know, it took about six years, but it was just like it said in the book. When I picked up and started drinking again, it was as though I had never stopped. It was as though I had been drinking the entire time, you know. And I don't know when I crossed that invisible line. I don't know if I was born with this spiritual malady, with this illness. You know, that's not important. That's, as my fiance likes to say, you know, that's the booby prize of life. Why? It doesn't really matter. You know, all I know is that one day I woke up and I realized that something was wrong with my life. You know, and I like to tell you that I got that brilliant moment of clarity and decided to, you know, run and get help for my alcoholism, but I didn't. You know, I kept drinking. You know, and what I did was is that I rationalized and I said to myself, you know, I guess this is just what my fate is. I guess this is my destiny. This is what my life is supposed. This is what my life is going to be like, you know. And I made compromises, and I kept on crossing lines. And I said, if I ever get that bad, then maybe I'll do something. And then that would happen, and I would go, gee, that wasn't so bad, you know. And I would do something else and draw that line, you know. And I would cross that line, and it wouldn't be so bad. And I would say, you know, that wasn't so bad. And I would keep drinking. And I did that. I did that for about the last 6 or 7 years of my drinking. I surrounded myself with lower companionship because, like every person, I suffer from a huge ego and a lot of arrogance. And as long as I could tell myself that I was better than you, I didn't have to change. And I'd like to tell you that again that I had this wonderful spiritual, you know, moment of clarity, but really kind of what happened and what got me to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous was really pretty mundane and pretty pitiful. I was married to a woman at the time, and she got sick and tired of being sick and tired of me, and gave me an ultimatum and basically said, you know, you either do something or get out. And I wasn't prepared to surrender all my stuff. I wasn't prepared to walk away from that relationship at that time. And so with my rear end in flames, you know, I went into a 30-day treatment facility, you know, and I paid, you know, I got a very expensive copy of the big book in the 12 and 12. And that's, you know, that's pretty much what the treatment facility did. But, you know, it's funny because I couldn't stay sober on my own. A couple of months before I went into that facility, we actually had tried to do something, and I couldn't stay sober even a day. And I had to get locked up. And I was able to get some physical sobriety in that treatment facility, and I was able to get introduced to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and as I said, I spent the first 3 months after getting out of that treatment facility at Jimmy's place. You know, and a good friend of ours, Paul, is in the back of the room, and he was there many days. And I know they were conspiring as to how to get rid of me. I'm surprised they didn't leave me at the Yolano Club on any number of occasions. But I knew where Jimmy lived, so I could have walked, and he was walking distance, so I could have walked. But you know, that gave me a foundation, you know. And we did something that and I'm not saying that Alcoholics Anonymous is has changed for the worse in any way, shape, or form. But, you know, I remember those days, and you know, we used to leave the meeting and go to Bob's or to Coco. Well, it's Coco's now. It was Bob's then, and Denny's, and sit up until midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning drinking coffee and talking about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and then we'd go home and go to bed, and I'd get up and be at his house at 7 o'clock, as I said, and we'd talk the program and sit around his pool and really just be some lazy bums. I mean, I wasn't working at the time. I wasn't capable of working at the time. Nobody wanted me to work at the time, for that matter. So it was the perfect opportunity. But, you know, that's what we did, you know, and we ran around as a pack. And, you know, they grabbed a hold of me, and they wouldn't let me go. They wouldn't let me out of their sight. You know, and that's basically, you know, what allowed me to stay sober initially. You know, and, you know, you probably maybe have figured it out that, you know, if I was in a treatment facility and I met Jimmy in 1984, but my sobriety date is 1985, that something doesn't match up quite right, and you'd be right about that. And that was because, and we read it today, in More About Alcoholism, I had a plan. And I didn't tell my sponsor about my plan. You know, my plan was like the guy in the big book who quit drinking, and he had a career, and he had a life, and he retired, and then he started drinking, and he was dead in 4 years. And that was my plan. My plan was is that I was going to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was going to be a good little AA-er, because remember, I got that big ego, and, you know, I'm going to make sure that I can help you. I'm going to help you, as Peter would like to say, and you know, and I'm going to have a family, and I'm going to accumulate my stuff, and I'm going to have a job, and I'm going to have a career, and then when you know it doesn't matter anymore, and all the only person that I'm going to be hurting is me, I'm going to drink again. God had other ideas, and I'm so grateful that He did. I'm so grateful He did, because what happened is just like what happened in the big book, what talks about in the big book. The obsession to drink came back. And one day that obsession came back, and it came back just as it does, and I had no way to not drink. You know, I had lost the power of choice when it came to drink. And I got loaded. And there is no shame in that. The shame is in defending the mistake, not in making the mistake. But the thing that came out of that, and I'm so grateful that that happened for me, because God knew who the heck He was dealing with. God knew that I'm that egotistical, arrogant guy, and that if He let me go on my, have my way and have my plan, then I was never going to be of any use to Him or anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not really. And I got to be done. I got to have my last drink. I got to be brought to my knees, and I got to admit to my innermost self that I was truly alcoholic, that I was mentally and bodily different from my fellows, that I was never going to be the same again, that I was never going to be able to drink with impunity. You know, and that's the thing about my alcoholism. It tells me that it wasn't that bad. You know, I have a great forgetter. I don't remember how bad it got. And I always think it's going to be different. It's that insanity of the first drink. And I had that. And, you know, thank God that I got to take that drink. Because I got to take step one finally. And what's funny about that is that I had been through the steps. I had done 2 through 12. I was sponsoring people. I was doing H&I panels. I was in service. I was going to meetings five to seven days a week. And I was in constant contact with my sponsor. And it didn't matter. I was absolutely powerless not to drink. And I heard something from my current grand sponsor at a book study a few years back. And he talked about that if we're going through the book, and it must have been talking to me, at least that's the way it felt that day. He says, if we're going through the book, and the book talks about something happening, and that we don't experience what it's talking about in the book, then there's one of two things that are true. Either A, we're non-alcoholic and don't need to be here, or we missed something in an earlier step. And it all fell into place for me because that's exactly what it was for me. You know, I did my fifth step with Jimmy, and how long was it? It was long. I didn't get that sense. You know, it talks about in the book that we get that connection. We may feel that first connection with God, with our Creator. That didn't happen. You know, I started making amends. And yes, there was relief, but there wasn't that real relief. And some of those, not just the promises on 83 and 84, but a lot of the promises that are scattered throughout the big book, weren't really happening inside of my heart. And now I know why. You know, the book takes something like almost 60 pages on step one alone, when you include the prefaces and the forewords and the doctor's opinion in the first three chapters. There's a reason for that. And it's because alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful, and patient. It is out to kill us. It's out to kill me. So anyway, I got to take that drink, and I got to get busy again in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to tell you that my sobriety has been tra-la-la ever since then. It has not, you know, but that's life. You know, I lost my sponsor this week. You know, I get to be here and share. And I get to know that he's watching and listening. And I get to thank him because he has taught me so much about carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and about being an example of the steps and the traditions. And I get to remember the good times. You know, one of my AA brothers called me on Wednesday, and we were talking for 15 minutes and we were almost laughing the whole time. And I was telling him some stories about the roundup with Peter. And one of the first conferences that I came to was also one of Peter's first conferences when we were still over in the old Sheraton. And Peter, don't ask me how this happened, because Peter was not trustworthy, to say the least. And, you know, there's a general guideline in Alcoholics Anonymous that we don't let anybody with less than a year of sobriety be in charge of money. That didn't apply to Peter. Peter somehow got in charge of collecting the money from the cash boxes, and now it's like really organized. I mean, if you stay around here, watch them do the cash drops now, it's incredibly organized. They come through and they get the money and they go to the safe and they do all that sort of stuff. In those days, they had like a fishing tackle box. Like the old cash boxes with the little coin trays in the top, you know, and the one big tray in the bottom. Right? And Peter was literally taking the money out of the cash boxes and stuffing it into his pockets and running around the hotel. You know, I don't know how it happened. His sponsor at the time, I think, was, I don't know if it was Barney or not at that point in time, but Barney Morris, who's also passed away, was integral in this roundup and getting it started. And, you know, I'm sure Barney was about 2 feet behind Peter and counting the money after Peter counted the money. But that's one of my fond stories. And one of the other fond stories is one of the last years that we used to count the money all the money on Saturday night. And so we would collect, this would be all the cash drops from Thursday night, Friday, all day Friday, all day Saturday after the banquet. And we would all meet after the dance in one of the rooms in the hotel, and we would count all the money. And, you know, if the DEA or the Narcotics Task Force had walked into that room, they would have been certain they would have been certain that some big dope deal had just gone, had just happened. We had, was one, as I said, we had, I don't know, tens of thousands of dollars stacked up against the wall, most of it ones. And some of it, I'm sure that had that it, that if there had been a drug dog in there it, with them, it would have, they would have detected the smell of drugs. Some of it probably still had drugs on it, but you know, because that's, you get all kinds of at a conference. But you know, and Peter was there, and we were counting, and you know, it was just, we had a great time. You know, and one year I remember before the conference. I think it was, I can't remember what it was. It was in the mid-90s, and we were all up in the hotel room, and a group of us, and we looked out the window of the hotel, and this is when we were down at the Hyatt, and you could overlook the pool. We were overlooking the pool and the jacuzzi, and lo and behold, Peter is sitting in the jacuzzi with his arms out like this, and there are all these bikini-clad women and guys, you know, in the jacuzzi, and Peter is a beached whale holding court. I mean, that's the best way I can describe it, you know. And it, you know, there's something about an aerial shot that, you know, it just, you know, it magnifies the size, you know. And you know, we all just got to have a good laugh and give him a good ribbing about it. And a few years later, his widow and I were on one of the committees together, and we had brought our sons down, her son and my two sons, down to the conference, and they being teenagers and being boys, they decided it would be a lot of fun to get the Jolly Ranchers out of the candy bowl that were in the rooms and open the windows and, you know, throw bombs at the incoming hotel guests. The fruit doesn't fall far from the tree. And, you know, of course, security got onto them and figured out what room they were in and went up and basically arrested them. And Joy and I are off doing our thing, you know, we're running around the hotel doing what we were supposed to do. And eventually she got called. I didn't find out about it. And she went down and bailed the kids out of jail and took them back to the room and, you know, and was just beside herself as only Joy can be beside herself. And, you know, I was lecturing my kids. And Peter comes walking in the room. He throws the door open and he starts staggering in, you know, as though he's about to pass out, with a Jolly Rancher stuck to his forehead. And he goes, "I don't know what happened. I was just minding my own business." Yeah, the man knew how not to take ourselves too seriously. You know, he took Alcoholics Anonymous very seriously, but he did not take himself too seriously. You know, and hopefully, you know, we all get to laugh, because the laughter in the rooms is so healing. You know, and the thing we get to do is we get to laugh at ourselves the most. You know, I have made more mistakes in Alcoholics Anonymous than I ever made when I was out there drinking. You know, I mean, because let's face it, I don't have an excuse now. I'm theoretically in my right mind, but I'm not in my right mind. The book says I'm an outright mental defect, and I'm an outright mental defect. But we get to make mistakes, and we get to laugh at ourselves, you know, and not take ourselves too seriously. But this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, one of the things that I hope that I get to carry, and that each of you get to carry, is not that we get to stay sober. Yes, that's important. But that sobriety, that Alcoholics Anonymous is here for our children and our grandchildren and our friends' children and our friends' grandchildren. You know, because that's the really important thing about the 12-step work that we do and about what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and the work that we do. You know, when we got here today, I know the hotel probably set up the chairs, you know, but The tapers were back there, and the taping had been set up. The water was here. The notebook was here. The format. The leader was here. The other people in the room were here. That didn't just materialize. Some people had to actually do this. You know, this conference had to be here. This thing doesn't just happen. It's been going on. The work has been going on for a year. I know because I did it for close to 20 years. And I watched it. And it's so nice to be able to come back and see it alive and well. And, you know, you go to any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's the way it is. Both sponsors told me that the meeting starts a half an hour before the meeting, and it ends a half an hour to an hour after the meeting. And that the most important people in the room, for me anyway, that I make sure I acknowledge are the newcomers. That I reach out, that I repay, as Dr. Bob says in his story, that out of a sense of duty, I repay the debt for the gift that was freely given to me. That I make sure that I reach out my hand to at least one newcomer and let them know that they're welcome. You know, I do what was done for me today. And it's funny because there's some people who actually criticize me for it. And I just say, you know what, that's what I was taught to do. But I have a couple of newcomers who don't have cars. They're in my car. You know, I bring them to meetings. You know, that's just what I do. And that's just part of the gift. I'm able to do that today. You know, God has blessed me. And God has given me so much. You know, and none of what I have is mine. It's all on loan. It's all a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous and God. You know, I may have, you know, my name may be on the title, but it's not mine. And if I forget that, if I start taking credit, then I will drink again. Because I'll drift. You know, part of my story is that I drifted. Even after going out, I drifted. You know, and it's funny, you know, it doesn't happen overnight. What happens is that it happens a meeting at a time, a Friday night at a time, a Saturday night at a time. I mean, because after all, those are date nights, right? And, you know, we didn't come here to be boring. We did come here to have fun, for crying out loud. But, you know, we back ourselves out one meeting at a time. And that's what happened to me, and, you know, and I still went to meetings, but I drifted. And, you know, I'm so grateful to this conference, because one of the things that happened is that this conference was a connection that I had to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it kept me connected to the program, however tenuous that connection was. And what happened is that at about 14 and a half years of sobriety, life happened. And I was not prepared to be able to match calamity with serenity. And my world fell apart. My world got rocked. And I had no way of dealing with it. And I remember the night, remember the night well. It was the first Saturday night in August of 1999. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go. And I got myself in the car, and I don't know why I did this, but I drove to La Jolla Speakers. And I walked in the room. Put my arms around Peter. Said, I need help. I need help. That same prayer of every alcoholic. God, help me. And he said to me, he spent actually the rest of that meeting, I don't think we stayed for the, we weren't in the meeting, we were outside talking. And he said, okay, be at 29th and Cedar tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock, 8, actually said 8:45. He gave me a break. He let me be 15 minutes early instead of a half an hour early. Just be there at 8:45 for the Sunday morning men's meeting. And that meeting is now my home group. And it was so ironic, you know, I'm such an alcoholic. And I'm so arrogant. He introduced me to a man that night, and just to introduce me to somebody. And that guy said, "Oh, that's good. I'm glad. We'll see you tomorrow morning." He says, "I'm leading the meeting. I'll call on you." And from that minute until the next morning, what did I think about? What I was going to say at the meeting. Here my life has fallen apart. I don't have anything to share of any value at all, other than my rear end's on fire, my life has fallen apart, and I don't know anything. And, you know, my arrogance, of course, goes to, "Oh, I'm going to get called on. Everybody will know me." It ain't grand. You know what the son of a gun did? He didn't call on me. I did write about it. Took me a while, but I did write about it. And, you know, it just, but you know something? God knew. God knew. And that meeting has a tradition. I mean, it has a custom. A meeting has a custom to call on people who were first, to call for people who were there for the first time and then call on them. And I raised my hand and said I was here for the first time and all that sort of stuff and didn't get called on. And you know something? It was perfect. It was absolutely perfect. You know, it's just what I needed. You know, take you down a notch, son. Take you down a notch, kid, because you just want, you know, your whole problem has been thinking that you know that you think you're all that in a bag of chips, that you're really something. And I'm not. I'm just another drunk. You know, I'm just another drunk who got beat up and got beat to a state of reasonableness and got to get sober. You know, one of my favorite lines in our literature is out of the 12 and 12 in step 3, that it's through circumstance, not virtue, that we come to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, discover God, and acquire the rudiments of faith. Circumstance, not virtue. You know, if I got what I deserved in this world, I wouldn't be here tonight. I wouldn't be sober. You know, I got to tell this story because it's one of the real blessings of Alcoholics Anonymous for me. And that is that when I was a kid, I grew up in a small town and I was not the most honest individual either. You wouldn't trust me with the money. Mother's purse wasn't safe. I mean, I had a good role model in my uncle the alcoholic, for crying out loud. But, you know, I was a liar, cheat, and thief. I was a pickpocket, and I was a shoplifter, and that's just what I did. And this is many, many years ago, and the churches had poor boxes in their lobbies where people who were visitors to the church could come in and put a dollar or some spare change, to donate to the church. And I, of course, thought that was great because now I had my own private slush fund of extra money. And I can't tell you how many times I emptied those boxes out. I never left any money in them when I came through. They were empty by the time I walked out. And, you know, I promptly forgot about that as my life went on. And as I was going back through my amends with Peter, going through the steps again, I went, "Son of a gun, I've got another amends to make." And the neat part about this story is this, is that it was a family trip that I took my kids back to visit my family who still lives on the East Coast. And my kids went with me. And we drove to that hometown, and I drove them around, and I showed them the houses where I grew up and the different places I played and did all the things that kids do. And then I said, you know, guys, I got a couple stops to make. And we went into, and I had called ahead, and I went into the two churches. Well, actually, it's a funny story. It was the Presbyterians and the Methodists who had unlocked doors. The Episcopalians, their doors were unlocked, but they emptied the money every day. The Catholics, they had armed guards. So I only had two churches to go to. That was the Presbyterians and the Methodists. And I said, I got a couple stops to make. And I took my kids, who were a little older and were teenagers at that time, in, and they sat and heard me make my amends to those churches and saw me write the checks to pay the money back, to return the money that didn't belong to me, to give them their money back. You know, and I get goosebumps today standing here talking about it, because it was one of those things. It's like, gee, what a privilege and an opportunity for being a dad to be able to do that for my kids. Just indescribable. And if I hadn't come to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, if I hadn't taken the steps, if I hadn't gotten my butt kicked, if I hadn't found God, I might have missed it all. I might have missed it all. And, you know, I look back on my life today, you know, and there are things that I can't believe that have happened for me. Yeah, you know, I still get resentful. I don't practice these principles in all my affairs. I still make lots of mistakes. But, you know, I've got some tools today. I take those and I make those mistakes, and then I get to move forward with what we do here. I'm busier today. In fact, I made a commitment to myself when I came back to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and started working with Peter that every year I was going to get busier than I had been the year before. And I've been able to keep that promise to myself. My plate is really full today, and I wouldn't trade a minute of it. I wouldn't trade a minute of any of my drinking. Not one. You know, I heard a speaker a few weeks ago talk about the fact that we alcoholics have a God-shaped hole in our gut. You know, we all know about the hole in our gut. You know, and if you're like me, you know, you drank for the effect produced by alcohol. I drank because it took away those feelings of being less than, of not being good enough, of being afraid, of needing you to like me and you to approve of me. You know, it was the first solution for my spiritual malady. And he talked about this God-shaped hole. And he goes, we get sober and we start trying to fill that hole with her or him. That's usually the first thing. You know, Peter had a funny saying, you know, the odds are good that you're going to find somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous. The problem is that the goods are very odd. And, you know, so we get involved in relationships and we try to fill that God-shaped hole with a person. You know, and then it might be a job. And then it might be a car or a house or some other collection of stuff. And the problem is it's never good enough. Because the stuff doesn't fill the hole. But God fills the hole. You know, it's that we each have our own individual shape. It's all God, but it's a special shape. You know, and we get to have that hole filled in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've gotten to have a spiritual awakening. I've gotten to find a God in AA that I can finally do business with. You know, and one of my promises to you, one of my promises is one of the promises out of the book, is that you'll find that God here too. It's going to take some work. It's taken me a heck of a lot of work. You know, that pain that I went through from 14 and a half years of sobriety, and Jimmy saw me. I used to go to meetings, and you all were laughing, and I'm going, I was ready to kill you because you were laughing, and I couldn't. That's the truth of the matter. You know, I didn't want to be here. I didn't want to live. But, you know, I just kept coming back, and I kept doing it one little bit at a time. And I've got a God today who I trust completely. You know, I don't know about you, but I always trusted God with this much. Not with the whole enchilada. You know, there was always a little piece that I wasn't willing to give to him. Because I was sure he either A, didn't have all the information, or B, wasn't going to make the right decision. It was all fear. It was all fear. You know, and I don't have a fear of God today. You know, I know that no matter what happens in my life, that it's going to be all right. That I can match calamity with serenity. You know, that I can lose my sponsor quite suddenly. I mean, Peter's story is that he was sick for a long time, but son of a gun used to go in the hospital. He'd get roto-rooted or some other thing done to him. And then they patch him up and he'd come back out and he'd be ripping and roaring again. And this time it didn't happen. You know, I get to watch people around me deal with things that I can't even imagine dealing with on my own, with their families and with their children. And I get to watch them walk through it with some dignity and respect, and with some grace and true compassion and true love. And they get to be my role models. They get to be my heroes. You know, and it doesn't matter whether you have less time or more time than me. You can be my hero. I can watch you. I can learn from you. And you can help show me how to act better than I feel. And I get to be comfortable in my own skin today. I get to have what it talks about in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I get to have a relationship with my Creator that I could never have imagined before I got to these rooms. Could have never have imagined. You know, and I'm going to leave you with a couple of thoughts. Peter's in heaven, and he's the new kid now at the meetings. He's getting the coffee. He's cleaning the ashtrays, dumping the butt cans. Hey, kid, get me a cup of coffee. You know, and that's as it should be. You know, he's home with Barney. He's home with Ron Wynn, one of his dearest, dearest friends. A man who was another hero of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they're just laughing and scratching and just having a good old time. And he's watching, and he's here. And I get to feel him. We all get to feel him, those of us who knew him. And it's just as it is with any of our loved ones. And what a gift. So I'm going to leave you with a prayer that a woman shared with me a number of years ago. We come to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our prayer is, God help me. And that prayer got answered. And then we ask God after a period of time, we said, God, give me. And even that prayer gets answered. Sometimes the answer is, if you insist. But nonetheless, that prayer gets answered. And then hopefully if we get to stay here, and we get to develop a relationship with God, a true relationship with Him, we get to pray, God, use me. And I hope that you receive that gift of asking God to use you and letting Him use you and be of maximum service to him and your fellows. Thank you for letting me share.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.